Well, here we are again, another Friday afternoon Green Rush Live show on Pro Cannabis Media. I'm Jimmy Young, the founder of Pro Cannabis Media. And as always, we ask you to like, share, and subscribe, not just to the Green Rush Live show. We're here every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern, sharp, I might add. But we're here because we want to talk about the business of cannabis. And we always have great guests on the show. And we even have some great guest hosts now that we're rotating in. And one of them is Josh Kincaid from the Talking Hedge. Hello, Josh.
Hey, Jimmy. Thanks for having me back on.
Absolutely. And I love connecting both coasts. You know that. Josh is in Washington State. I'm in Massachusetts. And yes, we are in mourning today for my basketball team. I'll admit it, but that's the only thing I'm going to say about it. All right. How's that? I'm not going to go into the reasons why, and I'm not going to cry in my leprechaun soup or whatever. Okay. We have plenty of championships in Boston. I feel very satisfied as a sports fan, especially now that I'm no longer a sports caster and every team wins now. Now, winning is we put those in quotey fingers, right? And that being said, I was very pleased with the season that the Celtics had, even though it ended on a down note. I was kind of hoping and planning for game 7 on Sunday night. Morgan Fox is with us, and I can see a still. Did he disappear on us for a second? There he is. He's all back. Right. All right. Terrific. Morgan Fox from Normal in Washington, D.C. joins us on the third Friday of every month to bring us what's the latest on legalization and what is a lobbyist. Morgan, welcome back to the show. Can you help me, please? Because we are going to be talking about the job of a lobbyist, how lobbyists work, and what are some of the tricks of the trade, I guess it would be. So, Morgan, thanks again for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
All right. So what's your job?
My job, encompasses a lot of things, everything from talking to lawmakers to coalition building to communicating with constituents of lawmakers that are important for swinging to get to supporting votes on, cannabis related issues. But when it comes down to it, I am basically just a spokesperson, just switching between various mediums and various targets. But I wanted to address something that you asked a second ago. What is a lobbyist?
Right.
And I think that that's a really important question because a lobbyist is anybody who talks to their lawmakers about what they want to see happen. And citizen lobbying is one of the unsung strengths of our democracy and something that is vitally important to changing the way things are and getting rid of bad laws and instituting good ones. And I think that there are a lot of people out there that they hear that term and it's kind of daunting to them, or they think that it's something that it is done by like unscrupulous people in back rooms, throughout the country or in the dark heart of Washington. But any single person that contacts their lawmakers and tells them what they think and how they want them to vote is a lobbyist. And for grassroots efforts like ending cannabis prohibition, citizen lobbyists, the individuals that actually reach out to their lawmakers and tell them what they think and what they want them to support are absolutely vital. And honestly, they don't get the credit that they deserve.
Yeah, I have some thoughts about that, certainly. Josh, I'd like to offer you the first question to Morgan. And yes, we will be talking about what Merrick Garland, the attorney general, said today, but that'll be coming. I know. I knew you'd be happy about that. And yes, I'm very much aware of what he said today. But Josh, go ahead. You can ask Morgan whatever you need to.
Just jumping off that last point about what a lobbyist is, if you can clarify, because there's different definitions globally, right? So wondering if lobbying is a necessary evil. When you look at the lobbyists in the US look at it as a normal thing, but when somebody in Japan does it, they call it graft. And graft is a form of political corruption defined as an unscrupulous use of political authority for personal gain. Nancy Pelosi probably knows a lot about that, but maybe you can explain the difference between lobbying in the US. How's that different from graft?
Well, I mean, by definition, lobbying in the US is just talking to your lawmakers. Now, what that exactly looks like it can run the gamut, you know, whether it's like a single citizen lobbyist talking to their lawmakers, or it's a mega corporation dumping, you know, millions of dollars into a campaign for somebody. So, I mean, there's a lot of wiggle room in that definition in terms of how it looks in this country. And clearly we have seen in the cannabis issue, a lot of that on all sides of the spectrum, you know. Unfortunately, the folks that are dumping tons of money into professional lobbying aren't always effective on this issue. You know, you see big MSOs and, groups that represent alcohol and tobacco groups that are starting to get more involved in the cannabis space, hiring independent lobbying firms that don't know the first thing about cannabis, as opposed to donating money and resources to the groups that have been doing it for a long time, like Normal or like NCIA or MPP or MCBA, all the groups that have dedicated lobbyists that their job is to just work on this issue and talk to lawmakers and try to sway their opinion. And traditionally, these nonprofits have been, unfortunately, pretty underfunded. And we've seen, I mean, this isn't across the board, but we have seen a lot of instances where, big money operators within the space will hire lobbying firms that, for insane amounts of money, really, that will basically just go to meetings with the advocacy groups and then report back to their clients with what those groups said that they've done, say that they were the ones that did it, and then keep getting those paychecks, whereas they contribute very little to the actual pushes to change legislation in this country, at least on the federal level. And this has been my experience. And it's not uniform. You know, there are a lot of hired lobbyist organizations out there that do a pretty decent job. But, you know, why do that when you can donate resources to the organizations that have been doing this for decades and that actually know the issue, right? It's something that I think that really comes down to a sense of control over the messaging. And whereas like the advocacy groups have very, idealistic and very well thought out plans for how to proceed. And sometimes that doesn't necessarily jive with, the business plans of certain like big market clients. And those groups will generally say like, yes, we really, really appreciate your support, but we're not going to let you run the show because we have a better idea about this than you do because we've done more lobbying than you do. Whereas hired guns in the lobbying space who may not know anything about cannabis policy whatsoever will frequently just say like, yes, we'll do whatever you want.
We'll leave that up to the imagination just for a second here, because we do have some breaking news, as we like to say in the old newsroom business. I get this marijuana moment. Tom Angel does a great job with this every day, and he seems to have the real pulse of what's going on inside the government and what's happening. And the headline says, Attorney General says Justice Department will address marijuana policy in the days ahead. Morgan, that's good news for you guys. What do you think might come out of this?
That's a very interesting question. So just to provide a little bit of context, I actually got that that message that was relayed to a senator that I've been speaking with in response to a question for information or a question for response in a recent hearing that was specifically asking when and if, or if and when the DOJ was planning to reinstate officially the Cole and Wilkinson memos,
right,
which, as your listeners probably know, provided guidance to federal prosecutors not to use DOJ resources to go after anybody, whether it's like, medical or adult use, that was in compliance with state laws. And the Wilkinson memo was much more directed towards tribal authority. And so the question was, very clear, like, you've stated that these are your policies, but we have yet to see an actual official reinstatement of these as policy. And now let's take a step back. These are policies and not laws. So like, while they may be guidance and they will provide a lot of assurance to people that they're not going to get messed with by DOJ, they don't have the force of law. However, they do provide a lot of peace of mind for people that are operating under state legal cannabis systems or under tribal systems. And the fact that these have not been officially reinstated, despite Merrick Garland previously stating that he was not in favor of using DOJ resources for that kind of enforcement and that he thought it was a waste of time, much the same way that federal prosecutors, after Jeff Sessions rescinded the Cole memo, we saw that federal prosecutors continued as they were because they knew that it was a waste of money and resources to go after these state legal operators. There's still something about having that as official policy that is a really big deal. And, while the response from DOJ to this question was not necessarily, it didn't say exactly what they were going to be coming out with the next couple of days. So, I mean, it could be that they're going to be officially reinstating the Cole memo or the Wilkinson memo. It could be that they're just going to release a bunch of internal studies. It could be something else entirely. We don't know. And, in the coming days could mean anything from now till election day, right? We don't know exactly what it means, but the fact that they were telling a U.S. senator that they are going to be making some sort of an announcement about cannabis policy at the very least indicates that they're looking at it heavily. And given the fact that the Biden administration has really not been proactive on this issue at all, and traditionally DOJ and other federal agencies like that kind of wait for leadership from the top in order to make any sort of like serious pronouncements about federal policy, at least in terms of what they're going to be using resources on, if they're actively studying this and are preparing to release something, no matter what it is, I think that's a really good sign that either the administration is starting to come around and look at this issue a little bit more carefully and starting to bump it up on the priorities list, or federal agencies are doing so unilaterally in a vacuum of leadership because they realize that the status quo is untenable.
Right. And I liken this to a tease. As soon as I mentioned this little item, this news item, you were excited about it because the cannabis community is so anxious for movement on this issue that any positive sign from the government is a good thing. Is that why you were kind of excited about that, Morgan?
Well, I mean, I'm excited about it because of the reasons I just stated. I mean, regardless of what it is, unless it's something like, oh, we're going to roll back. But I don't think that's going to be the case. I'd be amazed if that were the case. But it's exciting to see federal agencies under the administration moving forward, whereas, up until very recently, like Congress was really the only ones moving forward. And, they've had roadblocks that we've discussed on previous shows. I'm glad that that we can expect something. I don't know what that something is going to be. And I mean, maybe my excitement will be tempered heavily once we actually see what comes out. But, at the end of the day, forward progress is good. And, the fact that DOJ is actually actively looking at this issue, or at least they say they are, is a really good sign.
Yeah.
Are they actively looking, though? Because I don't want to diminish your role in your industry. I have a hard time hearing like, oh, the government is being proactive. I don't believe that at all. What I see is a 2000% ROI on lobbyists. And anything the government does is a result of money. So either they're seeing the revenue side or they're being pushed by lobbyists. I don't think the Department of Justice is going to move on their own. I think the prison guards and the publicly traded prison system is pushing against it. That means that even more money from lobbyists is getting them to move anywhere. There's a 20,000% ROI, not on average, but for a lot of lobbyists. A lot of folks who pay for lobbyists get a massive return on their investment. So from my standpoint, I don't see government officials doing anything unless money is involved, especially without, like you said, without the administration pushing forward. So I would think that it's nothing but lobbyists.
Well, I mean, again, I'm very skeptical about that return on investment when it comes to cannabis lobbying outside of putting that money into advocacy groups, because I honestly just don't see it. And like I said, I've seen these lobbyists just parrot back what the advocate groups are saying to their clients. So I'm curious where you're getting that figure, but that's besides the point. I think that what DOJ is responding to is a massive influx of pressure from state authorities, whether they be regulators or attorney generals or governors or mayors associations, that the status quo is not working and that they want clarity on exactly what DOJ is going to do, because largely like these state level government organizations are pretty risk averse. And while they had some sort of an umbrella of relative safety under the Cole memo that was a little bit more official, even though it didn't have the strength of law, the fact that they've been operating in a relative vacuum since then, even in a relative vacuum that has not seen crackdowns, they want something that's a little bit more solid. And the pressure is mounting for that. And we're also seeing that in the appropriations discussions, where folks like Senator Schatz are actively pushing for amendments to the appropriations bills that would force the DOJ to clarify their statements. And so it makes sense to me that under that sort of pressure, they would want to do so preemptively in order to kind of avoid that sort of black eye of being pushed into it.
Hey, can I ask a question? I mean, you guys know I have a sports background. I'd really like to know, what are the top 10 lobby groups, and as far as money goes, how much money goes in to the cannabis cause in Washington, D.C. versus, let's say, tobacco and alcohol versus the drug world? Because like every commercial, every morning news is another drug, where is cannabis? Are you guys even in the top 10 as far as like money? Look at Josh. He's already saying, no, they're not, Jimmy. Morgan, and so enlighten me a little bit about where you guys are, because we do know that money is part of our society. It is part of our politics. It always has been. And sure enough, on our comment section, we got a guy saying the MSOs are doing mafia style corporate corruption. Now, they're an easy target, Morgan, the MSOs, I get it, but they still have money and they have gotten this industry off the ground. So again, money does play a big role, whether you're trying to change policy or just operate under a capitalist society.
Well, when you're talking about money, and particularly when you're talking about influence, the money that is spent on lobbyists doesn't go to elected officials or to candidates. PAC money goes to them, which is why I think it's really important and something that has kind of fallen by the wayside when it comes to cannabis policy reform, is that there aren't enough people really giving to PACs that are trying to get pro-cannabis reform candidates elected. And likewise, to punish people that vote against them by promoting their opponents. So you can dump millions of dollars into lobbying, and the candidates that you're talking to aren't going to see a single dime of that. So I think that people really need to think about exactly how these systems work.
So how do they work, Morgan? I mean, look, I'm familiar with the graph that follows college sports around. Let's just use that as an example. Are people getting paid off? Tell me how money dictates policy.
Well, I mean, again, cannabis is not a big lobby, either in terms of lobbying expenditure or in terms of PAC or campaign expenditure. It's very, very small. That being said, it has the potential to get a lot bigger if people would be, especially consumers individually, would be more actively involved in politics. Anybody that's ever gotten busted for weed, even if on the local level, should be given at least a couple of bucks to people that are working to stop that from happening, or to return their civil protections that they may have lost because they have a criminal record. Even if it's just a dollar or two. But You know, the there is a definite dichotomy between like the amount of money that you spend on lobbying efforts, which a lot of it is just making sure that you have smart people that are actively working on the issue and are really talking to lawmakers on a regular basis and providing them with the information that they need to either change their minds or support their supportive positions and help them convince other lawmakers to change their minds versus money that's going directly to candidates or elected officials, which comes through PACs. There's a huge dichotomy between there that I think a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah. Well, this is why we're devoting the next couple hours to this discussion, just to see how this whole, I need to be enlightened on how this whole thing works, but I loved your opening comment about citizen lobbyists and taking back the democracy that has been taken away from people. For instance, whenever there's a ballot question, you know, those that are against the ballot question look for a legal reason to knock that ballot question out. Now, I'm obviously thinking about the governor from South Dakota on this one. How, as a citizen journalist or a citizen lobbyist, how do I pick up the phone and call Kristi Noem and tell her what an absolute idiotic thing that she just did? I mean, I can't do that. She doesn't give a damn what I think in Massachusetts. I'm never going to vote for her. Do I call people in her district and try to convince them to make that call?
So at a very basic level, constituent outreach to lawmakers, you can do through either like their individual web pages. They all have forms and they also have phone numbers for both their district and their local offices. So you can just call them up and strike up a conversation. And they really do take constituent outreach seriously, you know, to greater or lesser extents. And I'll be honest, you know, there are like lawmakers that I've tried to get in touch with that are just straight up like, if you're not a constituent, I'm not interested. But what some of organizations like Normal do are we provide people with tools to be able to activate themselves as constituent lobbyists a lot easier. You know, we provide forms for them to be able to contact their lawmakers very easily. We provide, you know, pre-written letters that then they can tweak to their needs. We let them know when is the best time to hit them on various things and provide them with the contact information. But at, you know, at very base level, all you got to do is pick up the phone or write an email or fill out a contact form. And, you know, while one voice might not be enough to bend the needle, when you get enough people together, then it's saying the exact same thing or saying something similar, they really start to take notice. And they take notice a whole lot more if they're hearing from actual constituents whose votes they need than from, you know, various activists around the country, right? So just the fact that they depend on your vote makes you a valuable resource to them. And the fact that you have a connection to them because of that locality and because you know things about like where they're from and where they're representing that they probably do as well means that they're more likely to listen to you. Sometimes, you know, it takes a lot of people saying that same thing to actually make any difference. But, you know, at the very least, you know, that's what democracy is all about. You have an ability to contact your representatives and make sure that they're actually representing what you think.
And it sounds really lame. I've said this before, but when you hear somebody say, "Oh, call your, call your senator, your house rep, or someone in your district," it sounds really lame. But the truth is like nothing's going to change unless you do that. So, for example, the National Association of Realtors spent $44 million on lobbying last year, and the beneficiaries of those are going to be like BlackRock, who are buying literally tens of thousands of single family homes. Goldman Sachs went into Florida and bought an entire neighborhood. So I'm at my wit's end. So I'm going to call my local folks, my house rep and senator in Washington state and complain because I can't be the only one. Enough is enough when people are literally like, they say that it's only 6% of the entire housing market that they're buying. But the reality is they're buying about 60% of the houses that are $500,000 and under. That's affecting the majority of folks out there. So if you're fed up with it, pick up the phone, email, do something about it. Otherwise, you're not really helping it. It sounds lame, but it, you know, power in numbers.
You're absolutely right. I mean, perfect example. Normal doesn't spend a ton of money on lobbying. You know, we're kind of a grassroots bootstraps organization, but we have a lot of followers and a lot of outreach. So I can call a congressional office a dozen times and they won't necessarily set up a meeting with me. I put out an email to our followers who are constituents of that particular lawmaker, and they get 1,000 emails or 1,000 phone calls from people. And all of a sudden they're calling me to set up a meeting. You know, it really does matter.
Good. Well, great. And obviously we're here to spread that word. And here's a thought for all those people out there, whether they be in our chat room or watching on demand, however this works. Every time you take a hit off a joint or a bong hit, make an email, do an email to somebody. How's that? Just as simple as that. It's like one email per bong hit. Hey, what the
you
hell?
Stop at like 2 or 3.
All right, fine. You can stop after 2 or 3. Hey, Morgan Fox, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on this third Friday of the month that you always do. And we really appreciate it. We wish you the best of luck in the future. We're going to take our 420 break a little bit later, but that still means if you are partaking at the 420 mark, go to the email and email your representatives. Let's make it happen. We'll be back with more of Green Rush Live after this.
Don't forget to smash that like button on your way out and check out these other videos that we've got.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hey there, this is Cheryl Murray Powell Esquire, and I'm the host of the Terps in the City podcast. I'm a cannabis agricultural dietary supplement and trade attorney. I'm also a hemp farmer, and I've been recently named to the list of High Times Magazine's top 100 influencers in cannabis. I'm inviting you to follow me along my journey as I move back to New York to support the adult use market there. You're going to get a chance to listen to conversations with some of my friends along the way. I look forward to seeing you at Terps in the City.